Hello and welcome to Roots of Today, the podcast where the past meets the present. With every episode, we journey through time, uncovering the lessons, parallels, and connections between historical milestones and current events to create a deeper understanding of the compelling stories and issues that shape the news. In 1858, long before the invention of television cameras or even the crackle of a radio speaker, politics was still theater, and the stage was Illinois. The U.S. Senate race between Abraham Lincoln and Stephen A. Douglas produced seven debates that stretched across the state, each one lasting hours. Imagine standing in a dusty town square, packed shoulder to shoulder with thousands of neighbors, listening not for 30-second sound bites, but for sustained arguments that could last the better part of an afternoon. These debates weren't governed by moderators, networks, or time limits. Instead, the structure was brutal and simple. One candidate spoke for an hour, the other for an hour and a half, and the first returned for a 30-minute rebuttal. Voters got the full weight of each man's reasoning, every turn of phrase, every weakness exposed by sheer duration. They walked away, not with a quip, but with a deep sense of what each man believed. Compared to what passes for political discourse today, the Lincoln-Douglas debates were informative, and as such, useful and important. Anything in politics that functions the way it should is obviously something unexpected and short-lived, especially in the modern era where both parties work hard to keep their voters ignorant as they feed them a steady diet of misinformation and emotionally charged propaganda. But how exactly did we get here? As always, this is Alan, your host, reminding you to grab your coffee, tea, or whatever beverage you prefer as we trace the history of presidential debates. The stakes of the Lincoln-Douglas debates could not have been higher. The central issue was slavery's expansion into new territories. Douglas, the incumbent senator, championed popular sovereignty, the idea that settlers in each territory should decide for themselves whether to allow slavery. Lincoln, still relatively unknown outside Illinois, argued that the nation could not endure permanently half slave and half free. These were not side issues. They were the very fault lines that would split the Union only 3 years later. What makes the Lincoln-Douglas debate so striking when we look back from today is how much actual education the public received. Citizens didn't tune in for entertainment. They came with notebooks. They printed transcripts in local papers. They debated each other long after the candidates left town. In a time without instant media, these marathon sessions were how ordinary people formed their political understanding. They were not passive consumers but active participants, weighing dense constitutional arguments and moral appeals in real time. And though Lincoln lost that Senate race to Douglas, the debates vaulted him into national prominence. The transcripts, widely reprinted, carried his words far beyond Illinois. When he ran for president 2 years later, many Americans already knew him, not from slogans, but from the substance of those debates. Now, compare that with today's presidential debates. Instead of hours of sustained reasoning, we watch candidates compete for the sharpest line, the briefest blow that can trend on social media. The Lincoln-Douglas debates weren't flawless. They were steeped in the racial assumptions of their time, and neither man could imagine a future of true equality. But as a tool for the public, as a means of education and deliberation, they stand apart. Voters left those debates with a deeper grasp of the arguments shaping the nation's destiny. In that sense, it may be fair to say that the Lincoln-Douglas debates were the most useful debates in American history. They demanded attention, rewarded patience, and offered citizens not just a performance, but a political education. Today, we remember them not only for their eloquence, but for their seriousness, and for the way they showed that democracy is strongest when citizens are invited to wrestle with ideas, not just images. It has been said numerous times on this podcast that for the Republic to be healthy and for liberty to flourish, two things need to be true. The first is a citizenry that is engaged, one that actively seeks out information for the purpose of holding the political class accountable for their actions. Just as important is the second, which is an honest watchdog media that strives to keep the voters informed about the actions of the government. Without that kind of a guard dog, the people cannot make informed decisions in the voting booth. Currently, we have neither of those conditions. However, the Lincoln-Douglas debates were one of those times in U.S. history where the planets aligned and things worked the way they were intended to work. A century after Lincoln and Douglas battled to capture the attention and the approval of voters in Illinois, a technological invention would change political debates forever, and not in a positive way. On September 26, 1960 in Chicago, under the hot lights of a Chicago television studio, the country witnessed something new: two candidates for the presidency meeting face-to-face before an audience of 70 million. Richard Nixon had been vice president for 8 years. He was articulate, seasoned, and on radio, his arguments carried weight. But on television, he looked pale and underweight, having recently recovered from illness. He refused makeup and sweat glistened on his upper lip. His light suit bled into the studio backdrop, giving him a washed-out look. Next to him, John F. Kennedy was tanned, calm, and sharply dressed. He looked presidential. Viewers didn't just hear two men, they judged two images. Historian Theodore White wrote in The Making of the President, 1960, "That night, images replaced words as the carrier of political meaning." After that night, no presidential campaign could ignore television. But the risks of live debates were also clear. For 16 years, there were no general election debates. It wasn't until 1976 that they returned, when Gerald Ford faced Jimmy Carter. The second debate in San Francisco produced one of the most famous gaffes in American political history. Asked about Soviet influence, Ford declared, "There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe." To viewers, it sounded as if he were denying the existence of the Warsaw Pact itself. The press seized on the stumble, and Ford spent the rest of the campaign explaining. Historian John Robert Green later noted, "The gaffe became a symbol, unfairly or not, of Ford's limits as a candidate, proof that one phrase in a debate can outweigh years of service." 4 years later, in 1980, Ronald Reagan faced Jimmy Carter in Cleveland. Reagan ended the debate with a simple question to the American people: "Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?" During Carter's presidency, the nation had suffered through high inflation, high unemployment, the OPEC oil embargo and gas rationing, and the humiliation of having our embassy staff in Iran held hostage for over a year. That one line captured voter sentiment more effectively than Carter's detailed answers, as it turned the election on a referendum on Carter as much as a choice between the two candidates. Reagan understood the television medium better than any candidate before him, and in the debates during the campaign in 1984, Reagan's experience as an actor would become a determining factor. In the first debate against Walter Mondale, Jimmy Carter's vice president, who was now the Democrat standard bearer, Reagan's performance was mediocre at best. As a result, the press began to amplify those voices that were questioning if his advanced age was beginning to make him unfit for re-election. By the second debate between the two candidates, the stage had been set for one of the greatest political exchanges in U.S. history.
Mr. Truitt, your question to President Reagan.
Mr. President, I want to raise an issue that I think has been lurking out there for 2 or 3 weeks and cast it specifically in national security terms. You already are the oldest president in history, and some of your staff say you were tired after your most recent encounter with Mr. Mondale. I recall yet that President Kennedy had to go for days on end with very little sleep during the Cuba Missile Crisis. Is there any doubt in your mind that you would be able to function in such circumstances?
Not at all, Mr. Truitt, and I want you to know that also I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
The room erupted in laughter, and the cameras had captured that one of those who was laughing uncontrollably was none other than Mondale himself. Journalist Lou Cannon later reflected, "In one stroke, Reagan turned a vulnerability into a strength. The laughter said more than any poll could." The 1992 debates brought something new: the town hall format. Yet, it was the medium, not the format, that was more influential. At the University of Richmond, A voter asked President George H.W. Bush how the recession had personally affected him. Bush gave a policy-heavy answer, but television caught a quick glance down at his watch. It looked impatient, even detached. Bill Clinton, by contrast, stepped toward the voter, softened his voice, and spoke empathetically about ordinary families. The difference was stark. As communications scholar Kathleen Hall Jamieson observed, the exchange demonstrated that empathy on camera is policy enough. By 2000, even body language could dominate a debate. In the first Bush-Gore debate at UMass Boston, Al Gore's exasperated sighs and eye rolls played poorly on the split screen. Each reaction was amplified in living rooms across the country. Viewers remembered the sighs more than the substance. The debate showed how television could magnify not just words, but gestures. The 2016 debates pushed the boundaries even further. At Washington University in St. Louis, Donald Trump paced the stage behind Hillary Clinton, interrupting frequently. At one moment, he turned to her and declared, "Because you'd be in jail." The line electrified his supporters and horrified his critics. Susan Glasser later wrote, "The moment captured not just a campaign, but a new mode of politics, the debate as culture war spectacle." And then, in 2020, the chaos reached a new height. The first Trump-Biden debate in Cleveland devolved into interruptions and crosstalk. Moderators lost control. The Commission on Presidential Debates made a historic decision. In the next debate, microphones would be muted to guarantee uninterrupted answers. For the first time, the very structure of the debate had to adapt to candidate behavior. But if television reshaped debates in 1960, social media may be about to rewrite the rules again. Platforms like TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and even YouTube Shorts thrive on 30 to 90 second bursts, the exact length of a memorable quip or a sharp exchange. Increasingly, voters don't sit through 90 minutes of a debate. They scroll through curated highlights, often stripped of context. Campaigns already tailor their lines for that world, for the clip, not the conversation. It raises the question, will the debates of the future even resemble debates at all? Will candidates speak past each other, aiming not at the audience in the hall or even the viewers at home, but at the millions who will later consume their words in a few seconds on a phone screen? The Lincoln-Douglas debates once demanded hours of patience from citizens who wanted to wrestle with ideas. Today's political media landscape rewards speed, spectacle, and shareability. Whether that means debates become less useful or simply change form is still an open question. But one thing is certain. Just as television forced Nixon and Kennedy into a new kind of contest, the social media age may be forcing us into another, one where the most important debate moment is not the exchange itself, but the viral clip that survives it. When we look back at the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858, it is easy to marvel at their sheer length and seriousness. Citizens stood for hours as candidates wrestled openly with the moral crisis of slavery, a question that would decide the fate of the Union. Those debates were not perfect. Neither man envisioned a society of full racial equality, but they modeled what democracy at its best could look like. An engaged public, a robust press, and leaders willing to risk losing votes by speaking in paragraphs rather than slogans. They were, in every sense, educational. They demanded attention and rewarded patience. Contrast that with today. Our debates are shorter, sharper, and more theatrical. We remember the sweat on Nixon's lip, Ford's "No Soviet Domination" gaffe, Reagan's one-liners, Bush's watch glance, Gore sighing into a microphone, and Trump's blunt promise that Clinton would be in jail. These are not policy arguments, but moments. Moments engineered for television and now consumed on platforms designed for distraction. This is where Aldous Huxley's warning in Brave New World comes alive. Unlike George Orwell, who feared governments would rule through censorship and fear, Huxley feared we would drown ourselves in pleasure and amusement. He imagined a society not shackled by force, but lulled into passivity by entertainment. Citizens would come to love their oppression, to adore the technologies that undo their capacities to think. In that sense, our debates have drifted closer to Huxley's nightmare than Orwell's. We do not silence dissent. We bury it beneath an avalanche of noise. Voters do not sit through hours of argument. They scroll through 30-second clips on TikTok or Instagram, often stripped of context and delivered as spectacle. Candidates know this. They play not to the audience in the hall, or even the voters watching live, but to the millions who will later consume their words in a viral soundbite. In that sense, the true debate no longer happens on the stage. It happens afterward, in the marketplace of clips, memes, and hashtags. If Lincoln and Douglas trusted citizens to sit for hours and follow dense constitutional arguments, today, we struggle to hold attention for 90 seconds. That shift is not just a matter of style, it is a matter of substance. A distracted public is a pliable public, and if Huxley was right, then the greatest danger to democracy is not the censor's red pen, but the endless scroll that convinces us we are informed when in truth we are only entertained. The question for us is the same one Reagan once asked: are we better off than we were before? In the age of distraction, the answer may depend less on our leaders than on our own willingness to turn away from the clip, the quip, and the laugh, and seek out the harder, slower work of democratic engagement. Democracy doesn't die in silence. It fades in the noise of our own amusement. That concludes this week's episode. If you find this podcast informative or entertaining, please like and subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen. The same goes if you tune in on YouTube. Also, if you have anything you would like to add to the conversation, or if there is a topic you would like to see covered on this show, please leave a comment. Until next time, remember this: get informed and fight to keep your political representatives accountable. Your freedom depends on it.